love me so. You might think I'm foolish anyhow, but I'll go where my God leads me, so I'll be good. Seems like we're running out of time. Seems like we're just running out of time. Young people trying hard to find their way through this night. Yeah, this world is so corrupt, only no one knows who's at high. You might think I'm foolish when I say, but I know my God's coming back one day. And I put it on everything I love. I wait for him until he comes here, yeah.
Running Out of Time by Victor Allen, who performed at the Arts Walk last Thursday, February the 9th, 2011, at the Exchange, located at 114 West 5th Street, downtown Los Angeles. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Tyrone Robinson. This week, we will be talking about the Downtown Arts Walk open mic that was held last week at the Exchange, 114 West 5th Street, with our in-studio guest, Tanya Bird, the education system in Los Angeles and Black History, with Tony Roark and Judy Lumpkin. And on the line with musician Victor Allen. Right now, I'm on the line with musician Victor Allen. Victor, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you, my brother Ishmael. Wonderful greetings and blessings to the wonderful creator as well.
Now, Victor, we opened the show with the song Running Out of Time. Can you tell us about the meaning and origin of that song?
Wow. It's one of those songs that were basically, it was empowered by a spiritual overwhelming that particularly, and I wrote it about 2 years ago, and it was essentially a calling out to, you know, everyone in general. You know, there was no basic gender, you know, planned. But it was just to bring to the attention how we're running out of time.
Mm-hmm.
So much of life is instant this, instant that. And we almost forget what the real purpose, you know, of why we're here, why we're on this planet, why we're living, why we're even born into this world.
Mm-hmm.
That was basically the key motivator for the song.
Okay. Well, look,
that was kind of the opening of it.
You were also part of the Arts Walk held last week at the Exchange. Can you tell us about that?
It was really great. I always love being a participant at Art Walk. It gives me an opportunity to express some of the things that I've been working on in my creative world. And being an entertainer as a musician, this has been, you know, a gift that was given to me since my birth. And over the years, cultivating it and trying to define myself as an entertainer and not allow myself to get caught up in so much of the outside of the music. I wanted to always be able to express what's going on inside of me. So Art Walk always gives me that opportunity, and I'm always so thankful every time I'm there because I'm able to, you know, give my spirit, give my heart out, and really feel the response from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Just a wonderful place to perform.
Now also we have Benny there, right?
Yes, he just happened to step out for a quick moment.
Oh, okay.
He had to In Arkansas, he also is just a wonderful creative and just a blessed friend just to have. He's had his battles and struggles, you know, with, you know, Skid Row, like myself. So we're always being blessed. Matter of fact, we were at some service this Sunday, and it was just really, you know, some good spiritual food to receive the other day.
Victor, for those who would like to get in contact with you for performance, what is your contact information?
You can contact me through, of course, my Facebook. You can find me there under either the Juki Music Project, which is JU-KIE Music Project, and that's Facebook, or you can find me under Vicar, VicarAlleM Allen /Facebook.com.
Okay.
And so those would probably be the two quickest ways to email me, or of course you can reach me by my business or so.
And your email is what?
That's VictorAllen71 at yahoo.com.
Okay, Victor, enjoy talking to you. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, and everyone stay blessed and have a great evening.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, now we have with us in the studio tonight Ms. Tonya Bird. She's a longtime member of Soul Vision, the organization founded by the late Sunjia Ali. She is a writer and artist. She performed last week at the Arts Walk and also displayed some of her artwork. Tonya, welcome to the Coonrod Report.
Thank you. Good evening.
Yes. Can you tell us a little about yourself? Where did you go to school and how did you get into writing and the creative arts?
Yes. I went to school here in Los Angeles, and I started writing as a very young child and doing collages as school projects. And I started making my first collage that I did that was very significant was the Rodney King Riot. And after I did the Rodney King Riot, I did the Aftermath, which I won an award with the LA 4 Defense Committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now what was the Arts Walk like for you?
I found that the Arts Walk was very interesting, and I was very pleased to be a part of it. The Arts Walk gave me an opportunity to show some of my artwork, plus other wonderful artists in the LA area. I was really surprised. I hadn't ever attended before, and I didn't realize that it was such a magnificent event, and I was very pleased to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. We're very pleased to have you there. Also.
Thank you.
Now, how did you meet Sunjia Ali?
Well, you know, I've been looking back in some of my old periodicals, and I've been performing in different events throughout the community, and it seems that I've been knowing Sunjia since the late 90s, perhaps 1998, 1990 on through 2001, 2003. We were the frontline poets, and we performed all over Los Angeles, at the Galleria, at churches, and we did quite a few events. We were at the Carson Community Center. So I had really spent a lot of significant time with Sunjia Ali and the frontline poets.
Wonderful. Now, for those who want to get in contact with you, what is your contact information?
Well, my contact information right now is Miss Beautiful, that's small case, .bird34@gmail.com. Or you can reach me at area code 562-277-2216.
Okay, thank you, Tonya. And we will be hearing from you in the Ether portion of our show and also during our community calendar that's getting ready to come up now.
Oh, thank you very much.
Now, at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Tonya Bird for our community calendar.
This is the community calendar for February. Sunday, February 19, 2012, at 2 p.m., Drama Stage Kierman will present the movie Skid Row, one-third of the Grammy Award-winning group, the Fugees, featuring Praz, who came down to Skid Row and lived on the streets as a homeless person and did the documentary on Skid Row. Again, Sunday, February the 19th, 2012 at 2 p.m., the movie Skid Row. On Sunday, February the 26th, 2012, at 2 p.m., Drama Stage Cameron Community Outreach Program, also known as DCOP, will distribute hygiene kits and clothing to the community. Again, the date, Sunday, February 26th, 2012, at 2 p.m., we will be distributing hygiene kits. For more information on these events, please call area code 323-850-4436. And the exchange is located at 114 West 5th Street, Los Angeles, California. If you have any community events that you would like announced on our show, send the information to Drama Stage EL, that's one word, Drama Stage EL at yahoo.com. Attention, Earlene Anthony, E-A-R-L-E-A-N Anthony. And once again, our call number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Thank you, Ms. Tanya Bird. We're back with our other two in-studio guests, Ms. Toni Roark and Judy Lumpkin, two longtime educators in the Los Angeles school system. Toni and Judy, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you.
The topic that we're going to discuss is the education system in Los Angeles and also Black History Month. First of all, can each of you tell us about your background in education in the Los Angeles school system? Let's start with you, Toni, and then Judy.
Sure. I am a native from L.A. I was educated in starting with 36th Street Elementary, Poche Junior High School, and on to Fairfax High School. From there, I went to West L.A. City College. I majored in journalism, received my AA, and I went to from there to Cal State Northridge. And my major there was advertising graphic design. Once I left there, I trained as a professional makeup artist, and I got into production. And after a lengthy stint with LAUSD, I was a parent rep, and I volunteered on pretty much every level, from the independent districts to downtown, at central location. And from there, I've gotten into ministry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Judy?
Thank you, Melvin. My name is Judy Lumpkin, and I originally grew up in a small town in Texas, but I've been out here in California since the 70s. I went to high school out in West Covina, and I've been here in the Los Angeles area ever since I got married, because my husband is from here, and that was back in the 80s. So my involvement with the school district started back in the 80s, where I did a lot of subbing, and I've been a classroom teacher. I taught high school and junior high school science. I was a biology major and graduated from Cal State LA. And I also worked with the district in their information technology section. But I've had a lot of involvement with my son. He's 18 now, but he had a learning disability that he had to work through. And so I was his advocate, you know, fighting for him on almost a daily basis to see to it that he got all of his educational rights. So I've had involvement also with a lot of the, you know, parent groups at the various schools that he's gone to, and That's where my, involvement took place.
Okay. Now, one of the major topics in the news is the scandal at the elementary school where, you know, where these two teachers were blindfolding some of the students and feeding them his cement. And can I get some comments from each one of you, your thoughts on that particular situation?
Certainly, yes. Excuse me, as a parent rep, my main concerns was the mental health of our children, especially in Los Angeles. I always said that by the time you're 5 years old in Los Angeles, you've witnessed some sort of traumatic or experienced some sort of trauma in your life. And certainly one of the things that stood out for me is at elementary and middle school level, our children are subjected to, or exposed to rather, many different things, many inappropriate things. Our children, when they have to go to the restroom at a young age, many times they have to go with another child. Children, to me, should not be unsupervised in the bathroom. Let alone to really educate them and to speak on the things that can happen to them inappropriately. I just really hadn't seen evidence of it being done in the classroom. And we give our children to the schools 8 hours a day. You know, so I'm going to start with that.
Okay, Judy?
Having worked as a junior high and a high school teacher, every campus is like its own separate fortress, so to speak. And I experienced things at the junior high school that I worked at and at the high school that I didn't see on the news. Because there are so many schools and, things can go undetected, unfortunately, for a long, long time. You know, we had a teacher that was very seriously hurt at the junior high school that I worked at. And, I didn't see that on Channel 2, 4, 7, 11, 9, or 13, and it was really a horrible situation where it was an accident where a student bumped into her. But the last I heard, she was a veteran teacher, but she was not able to teach after that time. So, especially now with all of the budget cuts that have come down, and you have a lot less staff than you've ever had in the history, of the school district. There are not as many people as are needed to really mind the store, so to speak. And so that is how some of these things can go undetected for a long period of time.
Yeah, that's my next question. How could something like this go undetected for such a long time? It seemed like some other teacher or administrator. What are your thoughts on that?
Once you close that, that door as a teacher, you enter into your own separate world, so to speak. And, everything begins and ends with you. And again, with the limited staff that they have now, there are just not a lot of people to go around and check on these things, as there should be,
Is there a major difference between the quality of teachers in the public schools and then as opposed to the private schools?
I think teachers are similarly trained But I think that the standards differ. Certainly incidents differ. And when you have incidents like these that happen, involving staff and involving inappropriate behavior, many times it may be a couple of children that are picked on like that. To get an alliance of parents to come forth and to speak is much more difficult now and has been in the last 20 years of education that I know of. That's when my children were in school. But what I've noticed is that during the influx of language barriers and other cultural things that go mm-hmm. on, it's become more difficult.
Okay, well,
for that alliance to happen.
Let me ask this. And how about the PTAs? Do they have any influence?
PTA has gone through a lot of things this last 20, 30 years where it's somewhat been dismantled. Dismantled. Yeah, there are some schools I experienced that no longer had PTA.
Okay.
The councils came in. The Title I councils, district advisory, compensatory education, which is at the local level and central level, were the replacements. The focus was on Title I, which is the financial effect or lack of financial effect that has and how it plays into the education and the mindset of a child. So a lot of things were directed to Title I that used to be issues of the PTA, so they ended up becoming somewhat eliminated in their focus mm-hmm. and being focused on or highlighted.
Okay.
I mean, that's my opinion.
Okay.
The focus has really moved from everything being handled by the, district headquarters, and it's been moved to the school itself handling its own finances and making its own budget and so forth. And I see that at my son's high school. You know, as I go to the different meetings, there has been a shift in, the district headquarters handling everything. Mm-hmm. It's changed from them doing it, and now they really want the school to be, and the parents to be more involved in the budgeting and all of those processes. And what makes it hard again is that we do have a language barrier with, many of the parents. And so there's communication issues, and especially when you're dealing with very complicated budget type, issues, it's very delicate, mm-hmm. very delicate.
Now, they decided to clean house at this particular school from the principal all the way down to the janitor. What do you think about that?
When I first heard it, I felt that it overkill was the word that, that came to me. And I know that they feel that, that may be necessary. But somehow I feel, as a parent, I feel that, I just feel that it was too stringent of a move, It was a bit too much.
Okay. I thought we had a call online, but we'll move right along. Tyrone, you.
I do have a question. With Los Angeles Unified School District, knowing that it is shorthanded, why is it still building more of these schools around the city? I mean, I see them coming up left and right all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I see them coming up in neighborhoods that used to be plagued by drug dealers and drug usage. And I kind of look at that as a way to curtail the drug activity in those communities by building these schools, because the users and dealers, you know, they will be penalized seriously if they get caught in these areas. But why again, why with the shortage that there is in teachers and, mm-hmm. and overseers, why do they continue to build these schools?
I know I asked the question myself, but I think they had contracts that they had to fulfill, you know, that were already in process, and they had, you know, they had bonds that, you know, were allocated for that, so they had to, you know, fulfill their obligations.
So I know you don't have the answers, but it's just a question. Why weren't those bonds or those funds allocated to hiring more overseers, hiring more teachers, hiring, you know, that kind of thing? And, mm-hmm. and I know you don't have those answers, but
it's a very complicated system, because, you know, when you start talking about hiring people, you mm-hmm. you know, just at our high school, we wanted to hire a parent rep, and we were told that there were already people on a list, you know, at the district, mm-hmm. and that seniority had to be honored and so forth. So it's not that easy, you know, mm-hmm. to do that. And mm-hmm. also there is a push to return everything to the traditional school year. Mm-hmm. And so there was quite an influx of students over the last few years here in the LA area. Mm-hmm. And so in order to accommodate that, they started, you know, moving to the year-round schedule. Mm-hmm. But now they really want everything to go back to traditional, because it is most, you know, more cost-effective, and with the, you know, budget cuts and, you know, and the whole education crisis that we have here in California. Mm-hmm. They found that they need to return to the traditional school year. And so that's another reason why they're building a lot of schools. Mm-hmm. More schools mm-hmm. can accommodate more students, and then we don't need to have the year-round scheduling.
Okay, so you have the schools to accommodate more students, but where are the teachers coming from?
The teachers have to come either from, you know, the pool of teachers that are already available, or they have to hire from out of state, perhaps.
Mm. Okay.
I've seen that being done.
And there were a large pool of teachers coming in that were in different credential programs, emergency credentials. Mm-hmm. And during that time, which was like the late 90s, early 2000s, the classrooms were overcrowded, and there was really nowhere to put them. The class size increased from like 20, 22 to 26, 30, which became a lot, mm-hmm. and certainly a lot for emergency credential teachers. I, as a parent rep, could see that we were losing our class. We had dropouts at the high school level. A lot of kids were not continuing after 10th grade. Hmm. I couldn't count. But at the mm-hmm. same time, no one really addressed that. The address was that we're overcrowded, we need to, our superintendent at the time presented a multi-billion dollar, what's it called?
Proposal.
It was something else, but,
mm-hmm.
He got it.
Let me ask this, then. What is the gang influence on the quality of education?
The gang?
The influences of gangs. You know, so many high schools in the different gang areas.
Well, certainly in our L.A. area schools, we've had, there have been many, many issues of violence. Many that never came across the airwaves. That there's definitely an effect of it, because again, you're talking about small children who witness or hear of, and you know, they're sitting at at a table trying to concentrate on this information that's in this book. Like I said, you know, it's not, to me, it's not the whether the books are new. A child can learn from a book, but they have to be mentally adjusted to receive the information that they're given, and they certainly have to have a peace within to retain it.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Okay. How about you, Judy? Your comments on the influence of gang environments in relationship to education?
Are you asking whether you feel that having a school in a gang-infested area encourages the children to get out of gangs and the like, or is that what you're saying?
Yes, the effect on quality of education.
I think that when the needs of the gang members are met at that school, then we can see changes. I know when I taught junior high school, I taught science, and science is not always a subject that kids readily embrace. And I had students, you know, coming to my classroom, and they had some very rough circumstances at home. There were many single parents that maybe had to work two or three jobs just to put food on the table, and there were all kinds of negative circumstances that they were coming from. And so I felt that if they had had resources like weekly counseling, you know, where they could talk about the issues that they had in their neighborhood. Perhaps they had witnessed gang violence, and then you had other very serious emotional issues, perhaps incest, perhaps molestation and other things. And it's very hard for you to sit in a classroom and concentrate on any type of studies, let alone something technical like science, when you have all these other issues going on. And so a lot of the gang violence, I think, comes out of unmet needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to start by not just wanting them to learn the subject matter, but to meet their, the emotional needs that they have. Mm-hmm. And once those are met, I think then education will once again become something that is of interest to them, you know.
Now, are most teachers trained to recognize these particular cues that come up in relationship to these unmet needs?
I don't believe that they are. The teachers, the major emphasis in many of the educational institutes across the country is on their subject matter, and they are taught to be experts in their subject matter. But many of them have a little or no experience at all with even living in the inner city, let alone some of the things that these students are exposed to on a daily basis. And there has to be more education in, you know, our institutes of higher learning that's geared towards the issues that these students face on a daily basis, so that they would be able to see the signs.
You mean like training in crisis prevention or crisis intervention?
Yes,
concepts
indeed.
Like that.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I have a friend of my sister's who is a psychiatrist, and she decided to go for an extra year and get training in addiction medicine so that she would be able to understand the whys behind people being addicted, you know, to a substance, so that when she treats her patients, it's not just the regular psychology, but, you know, she goes behind the scenes. And I think the teachers need something. If they're going to work in the inner city, they need extra training to be able to understand what those issues are and to see things from the vantage point of those students and, you know, and their families and the environment that they're in and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're at a loss.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I just had a question. 2007, 2008, I went to a presentation at a private school, and at this private school, some of the students were cutters. Some of them were had ADD, and this is a private school. And from what I was told, a lot of these students would go to school and they were under medication, or they had to take medication in order to attend this private school. And the parents were basically sat down with the students and they were tested, and the school told them, look, if you want your children to attend our school, they're going to have to be on these medications. Is it the same in the LF Unified School District?
There was a bill, I think it's 2160, and mm-hmm. I lobbied against that bill, approximately 2000. And the bill was that it was mandatory to medicate children. And we really tried to stop that from happening. I left the school district. Mm-hmm. I believe we were successful at the time, but then it was reissued because when, you know, certain powers that be are determined, they're persistent. Mm-hmm. But it came to pass that it was mandatory to have your child medicated. It was so mandated that you could be imprisoned for not medicating your child. I can't tell you the blood, sweat, and tears from that one, mm-hmm. and trying to get parents to understand the ramifications of agreeing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we have, like you were saying earlier, Judy, yeah, we have another lost generation coming up here.
Yes.
Yeah.
It goes back to what George McKinnon said, that, you know, it's obvious that someone who is influential does not want to educate our children.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move into our next section. It's still dealing with education because we're talking about Black History Month. This is February's Black History Month, mm-hmm. which was created by Carter G. Woodson, the great educator. And what I'd like to get into the discussion on, during the time of Carter G. Woodson and Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, Dr. Du Bois, he had emphasized a concept called the talented tenth. This was just a little after the slavery period, and he felt that if 10% of the ex-slaves, the African-American, went to college, that they would reach back and uplift and lead the other 90%. But Carter G. Woodson, the one who created Black History Month, he come along with an excellent book that just blew that theory out of the window. It was called The Miseducation of the Negro. And he pointed out that as long as that 10% is getting a westernized education, then their influence, they would have more, their value system would be more in tune with the major society instead of that 90%. He felt the more Western education they got, the more distance that they would have with that 90%, which, and I think history have proven that he had a valid point. True. Yeah, would you like to comment on that?
I think I have seen what you're talking about. I think there has been a lot of what I learned as assimilation, where we go to school and we, you know, learn all of these European concepts, and then we fade into the woodworks, many of us, and we don't even think about going back into the neighborhoods that we came from and giving anything back to the neighborhood. And so we're not really functioning as the talented tenth in a lot of cases. We're it's almost as if we're getting ours and then not caring, you know, about the others that maybe need a leg up, you know, or, you know, need something extra. Well, you know, mm-hmm. we get ours and go our way, unfortunately. I've seen that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing I always wondered about, because My early training was in the South, you know, the Delta, the Mississippi Delta, the in terms of education down. And now was the hands-on type education that you talked about a little earlier. What I wonder about here out in the Los Angeles area is why the African-American community don't pursue Spanish as a second language, since a huge majority of the Spanish-speaking people in the world are black, you know, mm-hmm. And Spanish is such an important language in relationship to religion, you know, mm-hmm. like the history of Islam mm-hmm. and all like that in Spain and all that kind of stuff, and the ability of creating a bridge between the Hispanic community that you have here in Los Angeles and the African American community. Why there is no push to have Spanish as a second language like they push English as a second language on Spanish speaking people?
First of all, when Spanish was presented as being to the Los Angeles School District as being dual language, many parents and students expressed the desire to learn the second language. At that time, strategically, there was such a focus on reading and math. Science was set aside for a while, and many other vital subjects. Language was basically eliminated. Now, that's not going to condition anyone to strive to desire to learn the language because it was not accessible.
Okay.
It wasn't accessible. It's not what you do, but how you do it. And if you feel acceptance, it will spread like water. But when there's reservation and restriction, it's like don't touch, like you're saying, don't touch. Mm-hmm. Along with that came jobs that were requiring the dual language, and many people were not trained that needed jobs. And it's gone from there.
Yeah.
You know, it's gone from there.
How about you, Judy?
I think that she's right, and there's a resentment that has built up, and I've had to watch myself, so to speak, and not feel a bit of resentment because I have a teenage son that has, you know, tried to get a job some summers and has not been able to get one. And then when I went to McDonald's or Burger King and, you know, and I saw someone that was able to speak two languages about my son's age, you know, working there, and then there were all of these barriers and, you know, roadblocks and hindrances, you know, to him getting something. It left a bad taste in my mouth. I have to say that, you know, mm-hmm. because I'm an American.
Yes. You know. What part can the religious community play in terms of solving that problem? Because I think it's a very serious problem in terms of the communication between these two major groups mm-hmm. that you have here in Los Angeles, the Spanish-speaking people, you know, the African-American community, the mm-hmm. Hispanic community, and stuff in terms of getting them to network and build up their power base so outsiders won't be controlling their mm-hmm. destiny.
Well, I think that I don't know all of the specific government programs that are available, but I know when Bush was in office, there were a lot of faith-based you know, government-funded programs that were, you know, geared towards what you're talking about with the churches, you know, where we could bring the races together and so forth. And if there are still a lot of those out there, I think that that's what they should be used for, you know, to have these type of, you know, programs in the church to bridge that gap and, you know, and bring the races together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we got a final, I'm going to give you a final 1 minute comment before we move into our ether section.
Okay.
Starting with you, Tony.
Okay, I'll piggyback off of a comment regarding that. I was involved in, as a parent rep, in a program called the Academic English Mastery Program, which dealt with bridging the communication and language barrier between, especially, the emphasis was on minorities, black and brown. We addressed Ebonics and Chicano American English at the time, what was terms that were politically correct. And there was a really tough time getting backing from the school district. The program struggled, but also those that were involved became educated and respectful of each other. As we learn about each other, our hand goes from this to open. We feel safer. We feel accepted. You know, the exchange comes. And that's the key. One of the things that Judy and I as parents and friends have desired to work on is a program that teaches our children and our parents about their learning intelligences. Mm-hmm. Where what you don't learn or can rely on the school district or the classroom to teach, you can train yourself if you know the identifying properties and develop an intelligence of one knowing what they can and cannot do. Some people learn visually, some people learn kinetically, and it's important to know those things that will direct you into the kind of teacher you have, the kind of class that you get, the kind of the subject that you have. So all those things.
Okay. Judy,
I think that,
comments?
You know, education traditionally has been geared towards those students that are in what we call the middle of the bell curve, and all of the students do not fit in the middle of the bell curve. In fact, many of them do not. And this is why Tony and I are constantly always discussing that once you understand whether a student is a visual learner or an auditory learner or a kinesthetic learner, and then you learn what type of intelligence they have. Do they have spatial intelligence, or do they have music intelligence and so forth? And when they learn to accept their strengths and stop seeing themselves as a failure, you know, and when we take education and gear it towards their learning styles, and we do what's called differentiated instructions, instruction, then I think that's when we're going to see education really take off.
Take off and change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Tony Rogg, Judy Lumpkin. Okay. Now, at this time, I would like to move to the last section of our show, the ether portion.
If it's Monday night, about 15 minutes to 9, then you're listening to Voices from the Ether. My guest tonight, spoken word artist, performer of stage and screen, craftsperson, collagist, Miss Tonya Bird. Welcome to the Ether, Tonya.
Good evening.
I love the defining of words. Collage has been one of my favorites since the days of being a student at Otis Parsons. A collage an artistic composition of materials and objects pasted over a surface, often with unifying lines and colors. I like this one, the assemblage of diverse elements, a collage of conflicting memories. I think about the image of the Rodney King riots that you brought to our show last week. Quite a collage of conflicting memories. Can you share with us and the audience some of your film background? I don't believe Melvin touched upon that, but I understand that as a young girl, you had an opportunity to perform on some things that we're all very familiar with, especially from our age group.
Yes, I was. Fortunately, my parents had me in acting and tap dancing, and I did perform in 13 motion pictures as a child actress and 2 commercials. I actually played in the original 77 Sunset Strip, The Courtship of Eddie's Father, the original Dr. Doolittle, not the one with Eddie Murphy, the one with Rex Harrison.
Yes, yes.
And I have played in Camp Runamuck, the John Forsythe Show, Who's Minding the Mint with Milton Berle. I did a CBS Playhouse with Ivan Dixon, who used to be in Hogan's Heroes.
Right, right.
And that was quite an interesting time in my life. And as I said, I did tap dance with the Eugene Jackson and Sue Carroll Jackson's tap dance group out of Compton.
And one of these, I believe, was part of the Our Gang series, too?
Oh, yes. My tap dancing instructor, Eugene Jackson,
right,
was actually Farina in the
right
actual group. Yes, he was. So I have quite a background of being an artist, a performing artist, and now I'm a visual artist.
Right, right. And can you take a moment to share with our audience what inspires you as you do a collage?
Well, life itself. I was stuck right in the middle of the Rodney King riot. I was currently working at Daniel Freeman Hospital at the time, and I heard, I was up on the 6th floor or something, and they said, hey, they just brought a guy downstairs that got hit in the head with a sink. And then as I was leaving the hospital, there were buses, there were fire engines. I was just stuck right there in the middle of the riot. And being a native of California, I sat on my living room floor and I collected periodicals and pictures. And I felt what I put into that collage. And not only that, I did one of the second riot also, mm-hmm, called The Aftermath. And I did receive an award. I worked with the LA 4 Defense Committee, mm-hmm, and I did receive an award. I won second place for my collage on The Aftermath. And I have some collages that I've been working on. I've even done one on the 9/11 tragedy that we have. I put a lot of feeling into my work. My work is me. It's what I feel. It's my expression to let people know what's going on in the world and to get people's feedback to see how they feel about what they see or what they were doing at the time of these events.
Okay. Okay. You know, Tony, I couldn't help but notice your nails. They're such a lovely job tonight. And I remember you telling me about a recent visit you had to the nail shop. Would
there
you like
you
to share us?
There you go.
There you go.
That's being funny. Now, see, I don't really get my nails done at the nail shop, but I do get my feet done.
Ah.
Okay. And so I was at the nail shop. Well, the thing that tickles me about the nail shops is when you go in, they always say, hi, how are you today? And, you know, you say you're okay. And they ask you, do you want your eyebrows done? And you say, no, I would just like to have my a pedicure today. And they say, oh, would you like to get your little girl to have tips? Or they always ask you, you know, other questions. So anyway, I was having my feet done. And I have to be honest with you, I was looking at the Essence magazine. And I did put the Essence magazine in my purse.
No.
But anyway, so I was looking around. I was feeling a little guilty. I'm not going to say I wasn't. And I was looking around, and the girl saw me.
Oh, no.
Oh, and I was just looking at her.
And she's looking at you.
Looking at me. And so I kind of shook my head, no. And she kind of shook her head, yeah. And I was like, you're not gonna say. And she said, you want eyebrow today? And so I guess that was pretty much what was going
on. So you ended up with an upsell. You ended up with an upsell. Okay, that's great. That's great. Mm-hmm. Now, you also mentioned, because of our economy, you shared with me another story from your neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah, about the value of the dollar.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of us are not working at this time, and times are hard. And, you know, especially here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. where they say it's a church and a liquor store on every corner.
Yes.
Okay. So I go to the liquor store, and all I really wanted was just a box of Lemon Heads and a box of Red Hots. And there was a young man, and he was a very tall young man, and he had a little teardrop under his eye, you know, tattooed. And so when I went in the store, I saw him, but I didn't pay that much attention. But when I came out, he goes, ma'am, he goes, do you have any? And before he could get it out, I said, look, baby, I am so broke, I could make a penny scream. Okay? And not only that, when you see somebody walking out the liquor store, come on now, the liquor store,
yes.
with a box of Red Hots and a box of Lemon Heads, that kind of tells you that, you know, what's going on in our society
yeah.
nowadays.
Yeah.
Because normally I might have been walking out maybe with a big bottle or a six-pack.
Or a six-pack,
yeah. I went to get candy.
Right.
So,
yeah. Times are changing.
Yes,
Times are changing.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Tonya. And, you know, I can't let you get out of here because without doing one of your poems. You shared two pieces with us in the past, one about Katrina and the other about the tsunami in Japan. Tonight, because we have spent this last month celebrating the life and times of Sanji Ali, you have a piece that's called An Angel in Disguise. And it's about Edwina Gaines, and from what I understand, she is your mentor. She's a poet, artist, and the mothers of the Watts Summer Festival. And she was also the woman that introduced you to Sanji. So if you can introduce your poem and then do it, I think our audience will enjoy your visit to the ether tonight.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. This was written 12/27/02. An angel in disguise. There are all types of angels, here, there, and everywhere. Some even appear in other places. We don't know who they are, even when we see their faces. Angel Edwina Jones Gaines is one of those special angels' names. Mother of the Watts Summer Festival, famous for giving you some fresh fruits and vegetables, always thinking of others, telling you to do right, because we all sisters and brothers. The Bible, oh, how she could quote. Have you read the last book she wrote? To the unknown, she is an angel in disguise. For those who knew her, she is otherwise. Pushing to get prayer back in schools. Always sharing God's golden rules. From South Central to Washington, D.C., she fought to the end for victory. She's your godmother, your auntie and friend, and your love. For she was sent from above to join us together, to teach us to pray, to do right to your fellow man each and every day. Her art, another angelic message, demonstrates politics, education, determination, and unity in our communities. She chooses her leaders carefully, exhibiting every fine detail for all to see. To the unknown, she's an angel. In disguise, for those who knew her, she is otherwise. Whether it was a festival, a school band, or clapping hands, a church choir, customer, or vendor, Edwina Joan Gaines, we will always remember. Thank you.
Thank you, Tonya. That was very good. Thank you, Sanji Ali, for bringing all these wonderful ladies together tonight to our studio, wherever you may be. Melvin? That wraps up another session of Voices from the Ether. I return the show to you.
I would like to extend a special thanks to our in-studio guests, Tonya Bird, Tony Roy, and Judy Lumpkin. On the line with Victor Allen, my co-host, Tyrone Robinson, and a very special thanks to Jeremy, Sonia, and the Skid Row Studios. You can check out our past shows of the Qumran Report on iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, skidrow.la, or www.dramastage-qumran.org. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report, and I leave you with the song that opened the show, Running Out of Time by Victor Allen. fasting, running out of time. Seems like we're just running out of time. Yeah. Running out of time. Running out of time. Thank you very much. Thank you.